Hello.
Hi, everyone.
And welcome to week 8 of
The Bitchery of History.
My name is Max.
This is Allison.
And this week, I'm going to be talking about the Empress Dowager Cixi. And you're going to be talking about
Murasaki Shikibu.
Fantastic.
We're Japan. Spending
this week in Asia.
Yes. So get your sushi ready, your seaweed, some green tea.
Yep.
Ooh, nice. I get to go first this
week. You do.
Fabulous. So Murasaki Shikibu. Listen. First of all, we don't even know if that's actually her name.
Okay.
Murasaki is actually the name of the lead female character in a novel that she wrote, which is considered one of the world's first novels or one of the first fictionalized everyday life. So that is the name that she sort of chose and goes by. But because she was just a daughter, her name was not actually ever officially recorded.
Well, fantastic.
So we all throughout history have referred to her as Murasaki Shikibu. So that is what we will call her today. She was born in 973 or so in Japan. So a long,
not even four
long
numbers
time
in
ago.
The, in
not
the year.
Even four numbers. Only three numbers. She was born into a wealthy family, an upper class family.
Sure.
And her father knew that she was incredibly smart and actually said to her, "If only you were a boy, how happy I should be." Right?
Just be happy she's a woman.
Right? But she was incredibly smart. And at this time in Japan, Chinese was actually considered the language of like the learned class.
Oh,
it was
right?
kind of forbidden for you to learn Chinese.
The lingua franca.
Exactly. But
there's that
because,
SAT word.
There you go. But because she was so smart and her father was teaching her brothers Chinese, he, quote, taught her Chinese.
Huh.
Really, this means she listened outside the door and taught herself Chinese while her brothers were taught in the next room.
Fantastic.
Because that's how.
Sometimes.
That's how
you
have to do it.
You just gotta learn how you gotta learn.
You gotta game the system, you guys.
Exactly.
She married in her early 20s, but her husband died in 1001,
okay.
The year 1001.
Sure.
And after he passed away, she was summoned to court. Now, when she began her novel, which is called The Tale of Genji, is kind of highly contested. She may have begun it before she was summoned to court. It may be part of the reason that she was summoned to court.
Oh, okay.
She may have begun it only after she went to court. Who knows?
Right.
It's very difficult to determine that from the surviving
sure.
records. In any case, she was summoned to court and she kept a diary while she was there. She kept a diary for 2 years that provides a rare look into court life in Japan at the time. Part of the reason people think that the tale of Genji may have been more likely begun when she arrived at court is that it may be a little bit loosely based on her life or on what she observed while she was a lady in waiting.
Huh.
It follows a fictional prince named Genji, which means the Shining One. It's 56 chapters long.
Wow.
So it's pretty long.
Yeah.
And it really, I mean, it's almost, I want to compare it maybe to Game of Thrones. Eventually, I mean, Genji just gets old and then he dies. But then the story continues with his children.
Sequels.
So what's interesting about it is how, while it follows for years and years and years this prince named Genji, it is very realistic in that families who are feuding, again, similar to Game of Thrones,
sure.
continue to feud whether you come back and meet them 10 years later, 15 years later. All of that stays very consistent.
Yeah.
So there's great editing work going on. The editing may have been done by her daughter, some people suppose, and the book may have even been finished by her daughter, but it's not really finished. It leaves off in the middle of a sentence.
Oh no.
So then there's speculation. Is it really done? Was she intending to write more? Was there more? And it's just been destroyed?
Oh no.
We don't know.
Just in the middle of a sentence.
And it's incredibly hard work to translate. It was written in sort of the court dialect of Japanese at the time. So then of course that's a very specialized grammar and language.
Mm-hmm.
And none of the characters are actually named because it's rude or was considered rude to name people in Japanese culture at the time.
Oh,
so characters might be called in one scene the man in the yellow hat, let's say, not to Curious George, whereas in the next scene, if he is then wearing a green kimono, he will just be called the man in the green kimono, but it's the same character. So it's very difficult to get your head around it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or people are referred to as their station, His Majesty, the Knight, whatever it may be. Those are probably Western terms that may not be in there, but it makes sense to my brain. The book gets darker as it goes on. And again, there's tons of speculation as to why this is. She's getting older, so maybe that has something to do with it. She's getting more interested in and involved in Buddhism, so that may be coloring it. Or it may be sort of showing her impending fear of the samurai who are slowly beginning to come into power on the fringes of society. They will overthrow the government of Japan in 1193, and then they will take over. And pretty much everything that we refer to as Japanese culture today all comes from samurai warrior codes. The chapters were also potentially written out of order. Some of the threads are a little bit here and there. So again, great editing done on the book. The first copies of Genji have not survived, because it was primarily an oral story. It was just meant to be told. So all that we have from it are 12th century manuscripts. However, these 12th century manuscripts, new tongue twister, have been translated and discussed by scholars all over the world. I mean, even today, you can go to your library and get The Tale of Genji out of the library. One of the oldest, not the oldest, modern novel.
Yeah.
Written by a woman who we don't even know her official name. And even if we did, I suppose it might be rude to refer to her as it on this podcast in Japan.
What did you say a couple weeks ago? For most of history,
Anonymous was a woman. I mean, we do know that she was a woman.
Right.
And you can also check her diary out of the library. That's also available, an edited version of her diary. So you can read all about Japanese court life in 1000. I actually had a book called The Year 1000, which was about England in the year 1000. But what's interesting about that is so many people assume the year 1000, you know, coming out of the Dark Ages. There's not a lot going on in Western society at the time. But, you know, just go over to Japan. You can get 56 chapters written by a woman.
Right.
So, I mean, rock on, Japan. Pretty awesome.
There's always a center of civilization happening somewhere. There's always someone somewhere that is having their golden age.
Yes.
And it's not just the Western world that matters.
Not even a little bit. Yeah, the influence of this novel, we would not have Harry Potter, Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have any of these cool books without Murasaki Shikibu, so pretty awesome lady.
There you go. And that serial format, I mean, that is so much of how writing survived through the 18th and 19th and 20th centuries was the establishment of a serial book type thing.
Yes.
That's how...
Charles Dickens.
That's how he got famous.
Yes.
Was writing serial stuff like that as well.
Yep, absolutely.
That's fantastic. I really like hearing stuff like that, especially that far away into the past. I've been watching The Tudors a lot lately, and I know I've been talking to you about
this. Yes, it's on every podcast now.
I can't stop thinking about it, about how, like, how are people 500 years from now going to think about Donald Trump? That's my real question.
Mm. So, I do have a quote. Shall
please,
I save it
yes,
till the
please.
End, or do you want to hear it now?
Let's do it now.
This is a quote from her diary,
which
again, you can read. It's translated into English.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it's so appropriate for our podcast. And she says, "There are as many sorts of women as there are women."
Hmm. Sorry, I had a mouthful of water.
It's okay.
It's very true.
It's
just like, don't
so
box me
true.
In. We're all unique. It's a very humanist quote.
Very much
very
so.
Very human.
It's a very equal rights quote, you might say.
Oh, yeah. Give it a little spoiler for the end of the podcast.
All right. I'm so excited to hear this story. You've been talking about this lady since
I almost did her instead of Cecilia Payne for our first episode.
A long time coming. I'm ready.
Exactly. So I'm doing The Empress Dowager Cixi. It's spelled C-I-X-I, and I'm not 100% how to pronounce it. But on the Netflix documentary that I watched over and over and over again about her, they pronounce it Cixi. That's
okay.
Kind of what I'm going to go
with. We'll go with it.
So she's born in 1835, so not that long ago, to a poor Manchu family around wintertime. Not exactly sure when.
Okay.
And because she's part of the Manchu class, which is the ruling class at the time, it's the same family, basically, that the emperor was at the time.
Okay.
She escaped having her feet bound.
Nice.
And she also, because she was from the ruling class, she was taught Chinese, both how to read and write. They're not sure exactly if she was taught that on purpose or if...
She listened at the door?
Exactly, or if she listened at the door. So at 16, the Manchu go around, all around China, and they start collecting concubines for the new emperor. And they basically throw these big beauty contests. And they say, bring all your prettiest girls, your prettiest Manchu girls out, and we're going to pick, and we're going to bring concubines.
That's not what's happening at the beginning of Mulan, is it? Think about that opening scene in Mulan.
Mulan,
I haven't watched Mulan in a while.
Mulan, she's getting ready to meet the matchmaker.
That's right. Okay, thanks. So I was like, whoa, Disney, that's a really progressive opening.
I mean,
okay.
It's sort of the same thing.
It is sort of the same.
It's sort of the same thing because, okay. You know, Mulan is getting ready to meet the person who will be here. And, you know,
right.
She is getting ready. So she wins, basically, this beauty contest. She becomes one of 60 girls to be taken to the new emperor's...
harem.
They call them their consorts.
Okay.
And at this time, the Chinese believe very strongly in this concept of yin and yang,
mm-hmm.
where the masculine form, they embody that yang presence, and yang was very earthly power. It was very solid and very strong, and yin, being the female presence, was very, like, spiritual and ethereal, almost. Mm-hmm. And so he had this many concubines because in the act of lovemaking,
mm-hmm.
they didn't see it as just a, oh, I need people to sleep with. They saw it as a spiritual practice to...
Oh, nice.
In the act of making love, you brought your spirits together and became closer to your ancestors, closer to God, basically.
Right.
So they bring in these consorts... And they have this very intimate selection process where the emperor's mother gets to choose who his wife will be. And I'm telling you, intimate, they don't even take for granted her saying that she is a virgin. They literally go in and check to make sure that she is a virgin. So Yehanara, which is what she's born Yehanara. She's not born the Empress Dowager.
Right.
She's not chosen, unfortunately, to be the Empress. She's chosen to enter into the fifth level of consorts, which is the lowest level of consorts.
I already want to see this movie.
Right. I'm telling you.
Like, that alone is such a good scene in my mind. Because you've been following her journey the whole way. Like, yeah, she's going to win. And then gets
she
the lowest
get
position.
Right.
I want to see
position.
This movie.
Right.
Okay,
so
I'm ready.
So she gets the lowest position. And she's living in the Forbidden City in Beijing mm-hmm. at this point. And it's worth noting, it's very worth noting, that the Forbidden City at this point houses about 3,000 people. The majority of which are eunuchs. Because in the entire Forbidden City, the only fertile male that is allowed in the city limits is the emperor.
Wow.
One, to make sure that none of the emperor's consorts are accidentally impregnated by anyone, but also because when you make someone a eunuch, you essentially cut off all upward mobility for them.
Right.
Outside of palace life, basically.
Right.
So they're very good at guarding women, eunuchs,
mm.
and they're very good at... being politicians because they're not going anywhere.
Right.
So they're going to be truthful and helpful for the most part. They do play their palace intrigues and their games and there are crazy stuff, but that's wherever. So from 1851 to 1855, she never sees the emperor.
Mm-hmm.
Except for the wedding of the empress and the emperor. She never sees him because they call upon the consorts to come be with the emperor. Ever the crafty woman teams up with this eunuch that was close to her named Antahai. And in 1855, Antahai gets her a meeting with the chief eunuch. And Yehanara impresses him to such an extent that within a couple months, she's in the emperor's bed.
Whoa.
And then a couple months later, she's pregnant with the emperor's son. Now, for a concubine, for a consort of the emperor, that is the only way to move up, to become accidentally pregnant with the emperor's child, especially if it's a son. And that's what she has. She has a son. And so on the birth of the emperor's only surviving son in 1856, she immediately is elevated to the second most powerful woman in court, only behind the empress herself. So she goes from being the lowest of the low, literally all the way right below the top. Not only that, the emperor is said to love her so much that for the first 3 months she's in his bed, he calls on no one else. And he keeps her at court with him, totally subverting the yin and yang. It was not okay for women to be in politics at this time because politics were considered the realm of yang.
Right.
And so for a woman to be in politics was basically sacrilegious. And so he would keep her in council with him. He would keep her in meetings and stuff like that. Made a ton of people unhappy. A lot of the eunuchs were not okay with it. They're not quite sure how the Empress Shen felt about it, who's his wife.
Right.
But, I mean, what's she gonna do about it? You know what I mean? I mean, honestly.
It's true, I guess.
So, it's also...
Try and have a son. I mean, those are your options, I guess.
Right, exactly. So in 1860, around the fall and winter, they start receiving envoys from the Western European powers who begin trying to, you know, they want trade. They know that Asia is ripe with resources. And so when the Chinese basically say, no thanks, we don't want it, they start sending people in anyways to try and kind of like subvert the system.
Right.
And they end up torturing, capturing, and executing a couple of French and English diplomats. And so in retaliation for that, British and French troops march on Beijing and destroy the Summer Palace. They flee up north, and the emperor, upon hearing about the destruction of the Summer Palace, loses the will to live. On his deathbed, he gives Zixi and Shan seals of power and appoints these 8 ministers to also serve sort of as power heads for the young emperor, who's 5 at this point. He's going to become emperor.
Okay.
And with his dying breath, he names Zixi's son as the new emperor. Because at this time also, it wasn't just, you know, like you had a son and that was the heir apparent. The current ruler had to name his successor as his divine will.
Right.
And so Zixi, knowing that these 8 people who have power are going to try and usurp her because she doesn't have many friends in the upper echelons of power. She sneaks away ahead of the procession. They had to wait for the moon to be right, the astronomical sign to be right, to transport the emperor's body back to Beijing. Mm-hmm. And as soon as they leave, Zixi goes, I'm gonna beat these people to it. She basically like runs ahead of everyone else with her son. They get there. They literally rewrite the record to strip the 8 people of their power. She executes 3 of them. And she officially blames them for the destruction of the Summer Palace. That's how she gets them out of power. She has herself installed, her and Shan are installed as the 2 Empress Dowagers. And they basically run the country themselves. Within a couple months, though, Shan gets real tired of court life. She can't stand dealing with everyone anymore or dealing with all the politics and the games. And so she stops coming to court. So literally, it is just Zixi running this
all
empire.
All of China.
Right, being the regent. So during this time, she introduces the country's first telegraph, the country's first post offices, a modern army and navy to fight the foreign powers, the first electric lights, the first pavement, and the first national flag for China is introduced during this time.
Is it the one that we have today?
Yeah, it's the same one.
Holy cannoli! This lady just made modern day China.
Pretty much. It's not over yet, BT Dubs.
My jaw's on the floor.
She also puts down the Taiping Rebellion, which lasted from 1850 to 1864, which was at the time the largest rebellion with 20 million people dead. She puts down the Nian Rebellion from 1851 to 1868, fighting these 2 rebellions at the same time in which 100,000 people died. And from 1894 to 1895, she fights the first Japanese War. She institutes the first schools for foreign languages, the first foreign service, modern customs service, made an effort to end government corruption and recruit talented men. So she's really transforming this country using power that is basically borrowed. During her regency, she's really just running the country while her son comes to power. 13 or 14 years later, when her son comes old enough to assume power, she goes, you don't think it's going to be that easy, do you? And she becomes basically the ruler behind the curtain. That's what she's known as almost.
Yeah.
Her son is the named power. You know, they do the whole ceremony where he assumes control.
Right.
But nothing happens without her seal of approval. And so her son, the Tongzhi Emperor, which is what his official ruling name was, he becomes despondent with his life as basically like a figurehead. And he starts sneaking out of the palace at night and smoking opium and having sex. And they're not sure if it's syphilis or smallpox. They're not sure if it was syphilis and they spread rumors saying it was smallpox.
Right.
They're not sure if it was actually smallpox or if it was some combination of all those things.
Okay.
And so her son, her one real claim to power, dies. And it creates this constitutional, to use our common term, this constitutional crisis where at this point in history, there had never been a ruler of China die without naming a successor, without naming some kind of successor. And so they have to figure out, well, what do we do? And she goes, I got it. She goes to her sister and says, give me your son. She takes her nephew and basically has him created as the new emperor above everyone else's
choice,
critiques, choices, complaints, everything. She basically just goes, I want this guy. And he's like 4 at the time.
Well, that's why she wants him.
Exactly. So she becomes the Empress Dowager again. She becomes regent again.
Oh my God.
Right?
What a badass.
He becomes the Guangxi.
What a politician.
Right.
I mean, the Guangxi I'm already imagining all of the scenes with this movie. Because, I mean, clearly with getting all this stuff done, she has an incredible head for politics.
Absolutely. Yep.
And I guarantee you that's why he was so enamored with her.
Oh, probably. Yeah, absolutely.
And I just want to write that scene.
So that's around where I'm going to end the story.
Mm.
There's a great Netflix documentary
mm-hmm.
that is called China's Forbidden City. It was actually created by the Smithsonian.
Mm-hmm.
And episode two of that is called The Reign of the Concubine.
Mm.
And it's all about her. And it talks about the Forbidden City, talks about the construction of the Forbidden City a little bit, which
okay.
is amazing in and of itself. If
okay.
it wasn't created by men, I would be talking about it. But there's a couple things that I want to say before I really leave it.
Okay.
And that concerns the death of the Guangzhou Emperor and of the Empress Dowager Xiang. Now, Empress Dowager Zixi literally means the Western Empress Dowager, and Empress Dowager Xian means the Eastern.
Okay.
And that's literally just because of the palaces that they lived in within the Forbidden City.
Okay.
So they were literally just, oh, that's the Empress Dowager West, that's Empress Dowager East.
Got it.
So around 1881, Xian dies,
mm-hmm.
and there are rumors circulated that she was poisoned by Zixi because in what is known as that Antahai, the eunuch who originally got
right.
her the meeting, is beheaded for some crime or another. They're not exactly sure why,
okay.
but they do know that it's Zhan who makes the order. And so they think that it was Zixi who killed Zhan in retribution. Now, that is rumor. That is speculation. There is no real
evidence
of it, but it makes sense
yeah.
with everything else. Also, Zixi was very fond of poisoning, very fond of killing people.
Nice.
When she killed those 3 of the 8,
yeah.
one of them was beheaded. 2 of them were given silk scarves and told to go hang themselves. In Chinese culture, to be able to take your own life, you get to preserve your dignity. Whereas
yeah,
if you're beheaded,
but still think about
like,
that scene,
yeah,
dude.
You have to, you...
Oh my God,
right.
Why is this not a movie for
And
me?
Then on the 14th of November, 1908, the Guangzhou Emperor dies from what modern science has determined was a lethal dose of arsenic 2,000 times more powerful than what was necessary.
So somebody poisoned her?
She poisoned him.
This
is her nephew.
This
is her nephew.
Sorry.
They never dug up Xiang to test.
Oh, okay.
But they tested the Guangzhou Emperor and he...
Do you think she killed him?
He died the day before she did. They think she knew she was going to die. She ordered his death because he was the only living person who could have undone what she did. And they think that she was so worried about her legacy and her work that she killed him. Rather than letting it be undone.
Who came into power after her then? Do you know? I'm just curious.
No one really comes to power under the Qing dynasty. And in fact, this is around when politics and the way China is run starts to change.
Mm-hmm.
Because about midway through-ish the Guangzhou emperor's, which is the 3rd emperor,
mm-hmm.
around midway through his reign, they get invaded again, and they have to flee the Summer Palace. So she flees for a 3rd and final time, and they end up dying elsewhere. They don't die in the Forbidden City.
Okay.
But the British and the French invade again, and they turn this sacred Forbidden City into a barracks for their troops. Her story ends a little, like, unceremoniously for the amazing life that she had.
Yeah.
The end is not as exciting. It's not as sexy.
That's
so,
okay.
Yeah, and that's fine. Please go look this woman up. If nothing else, go watch the documentary about her. It is amazing.
She's
and
incredible.
To think that she only died... 106 years ago.
Did you find any quotes from her?
2 quotes that I'm in love with. The first one. The first one says, "Now they, the powers, this is Britain and France, have started the aggression, and the extinction of our nation is imminent. If we just fold our arms and yield to them, I would have no face to see our ancestors after death. If we must perish, why not fight to the death? And this one, we found it together.
Yeah.
And I just kind of died. And she said, whoever makes me unhappy for a day, I will make suffer for a lifetime.
I just love it so much. It's so good. It's so good.
So that's the Empress Dowager Zixi.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, blowing my mind.
So today in history, we have two great moments that happened.
Indeed. March 26, 1973, 10 women become the first women admitted as members of the London Stock Exchange.
That's fantastic.
Yes, indeed.
It's a big moment. And then on March 21st, 1986, Debbie Thomas becomes the first African-American woman to win the World Figure Skating Championship.
Go Debbie.
Hey-o.
Our term that we're going to define this week is going to be a little bit of a long discussion, but that is okay.
That's fine.
I did a lot of the research for us this week. We're going to be talking about the ERA. That is the Equal Rights Amendment.
Yes, please.
Also known as some unfinished business for the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
The complete text of the Equal Rights Amendment is as follows. It's pretty short. Don't worry. Section 1. Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Section 2. The Congress shall have the power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article. And Section 3. This amendment shall take effect 2 years after the date of ratification. This has pretty much been the wording of the text since 1943. However, the ERA was originally submitted in 1923. Alice Paul, suffragette, submitted it to Congress. So it's been around a pretty darn long time.
Yeah.
A pretty long time.
And it's not out of the norm for constitutional amendments to take a long time.
But it's this like, one it's seems like just 90 very... years. Is 90 years an average? The 14th Amendment guarantees all citizens equal protection of the laws,
sure.
Right? So some people are saying, well, why do we still need an Equal Rights Amendment? Now, you'll note in the original text, it doesn't ever say anything about female, women, mm-hmm. woman, girls, ladies,
yep.
just sex. Men, women.
And everything in between.
Exactly.
Sure.
So the 14th Amendment, which does guarantee all citizens equal protection of the laws, actually is the first time that the Constitution uses the word male, which is pretty troubling because
mm-hmm.
when I found that out, I was surprised, honestly, that the word male doesn't appear in the Constitution
right.
anywhere before
then. When you told
then.
Me that before, I was like, yes, it does. It's right in the beginning. And I was like, no, that's the Declaration of Independence, which has... all men are created equal.
But the Constitution starts out, we the people.
We the people, yeah.
In order to form a more perfect union. You can also look up Schoolhouse Rock, guys, if
you
need
go.
A refresher. So the 14th Amendment was ratified after the Civil War. It was mainly ratified to deal with race discrimination. And so in referring to the electorate, it added the word male to the Constitution for the first time.
Dangerous precedent.
Quite honestly, you can interpret that to really not protect women at all. Or anything other than a male person.
Sure.
At all.
What I would say to that is, well, the 14th Amendment isn't really doing everything we need it to do. You know what?
And
it's not enough.
Exactly.
So we have to clarify.
Exactly. And what it is too, and a lot of this information is coming from a great website called equalrightsamendment.org. But basically without an ERA, without something stating that all people, all citizens of the United States are created equal and to be treated equal under the law, any advancements that have been made in women's rights since the middle of the last century, such as the right to vote, any Supreme Court decisions on sexual discrimination,
land rights, property rights, inheritance,
anything
stuff
of
like
that,
that
they can be ignored, they can be weakened, they can be reversed. Just a simple majority in Congress can amend or repeal any of these anti-discrimination laws that have passed. And I mean, it's wonderful that they've passed.
They're still in
that
danger.
Can pretty
yeah.
much change at any time. Yeah, they're in danger. And same for the ERA. It's not a women's rights amendment. It is a guarantee of equal protection under the law for all citizens,
sure.
regardless of sex, gender, or race, or whatever it may be. And when you phrase the question that way, do you think the Constitution should guarantee equal rights for men and women or not? The answer is clearly yes. I mean, 91% say yes. It's such an obvious answer.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What kind of question is that?
And the answer is yes.
The answer is
yes.
Yes. Next question, please.
So yeah, if you want to know more, check out equalrightsamendment.org.
Yeah.
The Equal Rights Amendment has been ratified by several states, but it has still not been ratified by a majority
enough.
Of states. So
what,
it,
two-thirds majority or
it's
something like that?
Two-thirds majority.
For a constitutional amendment.
For a constitutional amendment.
So mm-hmm. the ERA is something that is happening right now?
It has continually been in process since 1923. So can we maybe get it done before 100 years go by? That's
we
only 7 years from now.
Yeah.
We can totally do it.
We could do it. All right.
Thanks for listening this week. There's a lot to go through.
Yeah.
Whew.
That's fun.
Well, if you enjoyed this episode and you're appreciating the dive back into the history of the Butchery of History with Women's History Month, and if you want to help new friends find the podcast, leave us a rating or a review, because those ratings and reviews help other people find the show, which is how we get to keep doing the show.
You can also stay in touch with us by going to Facebook,
The Butchery of History,
Twitter,
The Butchery of History,
mm-hmm, Instagram,
The Butchery of History,
and on our website,
TheButcheryOfHistory.com.
Yes, where you can buy some stickers.
Decorate your water bottle, decorate your laptop. You know you need them.
Put it on your bike.
Yeah.
Yes. And as always, we could not do it without the most amazing team in podcasting. Thank you so much to Jeanette,
Sydney,
and Jess.
The Butchery of History is a production of Ursula Major Productions.
And as always,
bitches get stuff done.